A girl grows into young womanhood on her family's farm in a small town in Michigan in the late 60s, all through the 60s. There are school dances, high school cliques, the riot downstate in Detroit, sewing lessons from her mother, kissing lessons from her high school boyfriend Earl, the Cuban Missile Crisis, assassinations, and 4-H Club projects. All of that growing up is contained in Love, Sex, and 4-H, the latest memoir from Traverse City writer Anne Marie Oman. This is Oman's fifth book. She writes essays, memoirs, poetry, and she teaches creative writing at Interlaken's College of Creative Arts. Anne Marie Oman, very good to have you here.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's always such a pleasure.
Two of your earlier books, Pulling Down the Barn and House of Fields, were both Michigan Notable books. And they, too, are memoirs about your growing up on that farm in Oceana County. And now here comes Love, Sex, and 4-H. How do these three differ, and what are you exploring in each?
Well, in the first one, it's an intimate memoir. It's the family stories, a close, intimate, you know, relationships you develop on a farm with your siblings. I was the oldest of five. It's, you know, it's right in there with the close ties. And the second one, I wanted to explore my early education. I'm one of the youngest people I know who went to one-room schoolhouses and then two consolidated schools and then parochial schools and a convent. And so the education was, I wanted to explore what that was like, the rural education element. And in this one, I was really looking at how the public persona was shaped. And my public persona was shaped through my activities in 4-H Club. And that was all happening. I was in 4-H for 10 years, from 1959 to 1969. So that was all happening in the context of the 60s, which is kind of remarkable. And that set up the basic tensions of the book, you know, this wholesome life on the farm against the turmoil of that era.
And you do a beautiful job. You take us through those tumultuous 60s. And while all that's happening, there you are dutifully and carefully sewing from that first dish towel to all the outfits you sewed for school and outfits that sometimes expressed what you were feeling inside, often to your mother's chagrin. Tell us more about your mother, because she really is a big part of this, because she was the sewing goddess in the family.
That's right. That's a beautiful description for her. She was an amazing seamstress and also a force to be reckoned with. I mean, she was helping manage the farm, raising five kids, probably not unusual for farm women of her time. But she saw this streak of defiance or, you know, rebellion in me and said, okay, we got to take care of this. And she immediately, like I was 8 and a half, and she enrolled me in 4-H Club, started with that first lesson. And just as a, you know, just as a powerhouse, she became a leader of the club. And
which immediately took the shine off of it for you, didn't it?
Oh, of course. My mom was the leader. That meant I couldn't get away with anything. And she, you know, really made sure that the entire family, actually not, I was started in 4-H, but she, the entire family participated in the club for all the years that we were growing up. And some of my brothers were into the animals and my sister's into horsemanship and, you know, prize winning pumpkins and all that sort of thing.
Well, for the city kids, would you tell us a little more about what it meant to be in 4-H?
Okay, sure. Now, of course, 4-H is a very progressive, suburban, urban, diverse, multicultural organization. It's really up to date and out there. But at that time, it was focused on rural life. And being in a 4-H club meant that you took on these projects. And the projects had to do with something that would help you in your growing up. So as a farm children often raised animals, those champion cows. And I was taught to make jams and jellies and also to make my own clothing, all those dresses, and to model, which I don't think they do anymore. But I was out there. You made your dress and then you modeled your dress. So that was an idea of creating a persona for the public that had some grace and confidence.
And what does the 4-H's, what are the 4-H's?
Oh, it stands for, it's the 4-H, the four-leaf clover. Each one holds an H in its head, health, hands, and heart.
You didn't have any problem remembering that. That is it. That's in your DNA now, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It sure is.
So here you are. You are trying so hard to make your seams straight and your hems invisible. Mm-hmm. So you're waging war on your mom's sewing machine. And you're doing it in a decade when what it meant to be a young woman in Michigan in America was being turned upside down, even if we didn't quite realize it at the time.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Everything was changing very, very quickly. And part of what I try to do in the book is make those dresses emblematic of the changing time in the era.
So for instance?
Well, for instance, I make my first real outfit is a very conservative sailor outfit modeled after one of the Jackie Kennedy outfits that she wore at Hyannis Port. And that was in Life magazine, pictures of that. And that was a very conservative, tailored kind of outfit. Mm-hmm. Two, the final thing that I make was a psychedelic rainbow colored dress that started out as a mid-calf midi, and I shortened it to a mini semi-formal, and it was, you know, just out there strutting. You know?
and having to model it, and I know at one point you're down at Michigan State University. It's like it's the big time
for all of this.
You went out on that stage.
On that runway, that's right.
And I couldn't tell if you loved it because you got to be somebody different or you hated it or both.
Well, when I was modeling in my own county, it was frightening, of course, but it was something you could manage because somehow you knew those people. But once in Lansing, it was much more competitive. The dresses were startlingly more contemporary and progressive and mod and all of those things. And so I was just downright intimidated. It was a moment of terrifying intimidation and sent me hightailing it right back home where I felt safe.
And the mean girl thing still happened in the 60s because
you certainly got
that when you were down at that big statewide meeting. I'm talking with writer Anne Marie Oman about her memoir, Love, Sex, and 4-H, which is really being hailed as literature about the Midwest. And Amory, I'm wondering if you'd read us an excerpt. This comes from those days in October 1962. I remember them like it was yesterday. We know them as the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yes.
And this is where you're struggling to sew a decent hem. At the same time, your parents are watching the nightly news, watching Huntley and Brinkley, which is something that my parents did every night as well. And you're losing the battle of the hem and your mom steps in.
Right. So it's called the invisible hem stitch. It's a secret hem. She puts the skirt back in my lap. She shows me how to hide the knot at the seam by tucking it in. I like the knot hidden, the tiny secret, a roughness tucked inside. She shows me how to catch the smallest bit of the skirt front, a needle's tiny bite, then another bite of the folded edge, then pull the thread, but not too tight. She says, go back and forth from the layer that will be the outside to the layer that's inside. Catch just a little fabric each time. Keep the stitch on the inside. Then she sits beside me, and I catch the skirt side and catch the hem side and watch for the pins. She turns the fabric over. Mm-mm. Too much of the catch shows on the outside of the fabric. She tears it out. She says, it's got to be invisible. No one can see the stitches. I hold the thread and needle and concentrate while the news blares in the background. During the Texaco commercial, they get coffee and she finishes washing dishes. She calls my brothers in from raking leaves. She feeds the little girls a snack. Then Huntley Brinkley again. They are only half listening, moving through little chores. Change, when it comes, is first about a stillness. The clink of the dishes stops. The voices from the TV shift in tone. Now, just the TV, just Huntley and Brinkley filling the air. A special report. My ever-moving mother and father stare at the TV, alert but without moving. Brinkley is talking about missiles, about the Soviet Union, a place called Cuba, a dictator named Castro. My father gets up and paces. My mother rubs her forehead, says, oh, my God. She never swears. This is what happens, he says. And I look at his face. I feel a strange buzz running through me.
Anne-Marie Oman reading from Love, Sex, and 4-H, her memoir, Growing Up in the 60s on a Michigan Farm. And boy, that moment, every baby boomer can relate to, because the adults in our life were so afraid. My mom did exactly what your mom did. Suddenly, jars of water were being stockpiled and canned goods were going down to our basement fruit cellar. And I remember walking home from school talking about we might have a war.
That's right.
And there was that sense. And I know, and you began to think of the fact that your father had been in World War II, and you started asking him questions. And those World War II veterans, by and large, didn't want to give up stories, did they?
No, they were very private about that experience. But from the way that he was so frightened of the situation that was happening and the way they reacted, you know, they basically created a bunker in the basement that they took very, very seriously that particular time and moment.
And then came the assassination of President Kennedy a little more than a year later. And we saw those adults in our life cry, whether it was teachers or grandparents. We saw Oswald shot live on TV that Sunday morning. I did. You did.
Yes.
Emory, how do you think all of that in the 60s, the three assassinations of JFK and Martin Luther King and then Robert Kennedy, the war in Vietnam, how do you think those experiences marked us?
Well, one of the things that I think happened to all of us was a vulnerability, especially for those of us who weren't out there at the forefront of things. We were receiving all that information. And I think that sense of, oh my gosh, what's happening to us? What's, you know, what we thought was a safe world was turning out not to be a safe world. And one of the reasons I wrote the book was in part for young people to see that you can come through that, you know, we're all marked by the times that we live in and the turmoil and the, to some degree, anxiety and terror, perhaps sometimes that we felt is something that you can come through. You can survive and be stronger. And that, you know, for the young people who read this book, that's kind of the message. It's an affirmation.
And at the same time, all this big news is happening in the world. There's the life of you in your school. And I have to say, I related so much because, like you, I left Catholic school in 10th grade to go to public school. But you did better than I did. I was envious of you. I crashed and burned. That was a terrible year in the public school.
Oh,
and I begged
sorry.
To go back to Catholic school. And luckily, they said yes. And I finished off at Immaculata High School in Detroit. But you made it work. And it seems like a lot of what helped you make it work in that public school setting and finding your footing in a new world was the fact that you could express who you were through the outfits you sewed.
That's right. It was a time when 4-H had given me the means to create a public persona. And it was the time when, even though women, I don't think, had quite yet found their voices, that's certainly coming in the time, they could present themselves through their style, their fashion. And I took that to heart, not in the ways my mother expected, but certainly in the ways that I could shape those skills into something that was, you know, a little style of my own. So, and I think we see that happening today again, too.
We get a good sense of the push and pull that happens between mothers and daughters. Mm-hmm. Now, is your mother still with you?
My mother is 93 years old. She's in a home, and she is still with me. Yes, I'm so pleased.
Has she had a chance to read your memoirs? And if so, I'm wondering what she thought of getting the voice of her daughter all those years ago.
Well, she has read the first two books, and she shakes her head, but then she smiles. So I think that she likes them. I think she feels good about them. I just recently put this book into her hands, but I don't think she's able to finish it.
Yeah. How were you able to recall those intricate, tiny, tiny details of that life that you and your family lived 50 years ago? Because the sense of place is exquisite.
Oh, thank you. I have a very good visual memory, but I do a lot of research and I talk to people who were growing up in that time and look at pictures, photographs. I pored over the old yearbooks, looking not just at faces, but at the backgrounds and trying to get in touch with all of that detail of how did it look then, you know, and even trying to recall what it smelled like, because that's a huge way into the sensory experience of the work. And then I also do something called a likely detail. If I know that if a certain thing was real at this point and a certain thing was real at this point, the likely detail is that it will happen this way, you know, that this is how it was most likely to go. And you'll usually see a little phrase like, I suspect it went like this, or I imagine it like this, so that I'm ethically sound.
<laughs> You know? Would you be able to describe the character that rural Michigan plays in your life story? Is there a way to characterize that?
Oh, I think if I were to give it a word, I would say light. You know, it, even though it was full of turmoil and often chaotic, there's always light around it. It's the light of the fields, the light coming off, you know, orchards, the light, you know, bouncing off asparagus fields where I grew up working in fields. And even in those tumultuous high school time periods, you walk out of the school and there is the light of openness. It's open space that still is with us. That's probably what marks it as a Midwestern literature as well, is that sense of light and air.
What's been the kind of final impact in your heart of sharing, going back in these memories, digging them up, reviving them, putting them on these pages of Love, Sex, and 4-H, and putting it out there? What has that been like for you?
I think what happens in my heart is that I make the meaning explicit that I always sensed implicitly. So I'm creating meaning from kind of hidden currents. That old invisible hem is surfacing, and I'm actually opening it up and looking at it and saying, oh, that's how it works. That's how it worked for me. That's how it worked for many of us. And we should just celebrate that and and honor that past if we can, even those hard times. So it's about, I think for me, making that meaning outward and bringing to the surface what that time meant for us.
Anne Marie Oman, her latest memoir, Love, Sex, and 4-H, a wonderful read. Thank you so much for sharing with us, Anne Marie.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's such a pleasure.